This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
www.cleanhouston.org. That's www.cleanhouston.org. This is KPFT Houston.
Welcome to another edition of the New Capital Show. I'm Leo Gold, your host. A pleasure to be with you on this January 31st of 2008. www.newcapitalshow.com is our website. Today, we're going to present to you the story of stuff. This is another phenomenon from the internet. Internet video, internet audio seem to be proliferating very rapidly. Things that get out there spread in an almost viral fashion, and something called the story of stuff made its way to my attention several weeks ago. A young woman named Annie Leonard has made an animation that describes the incredible waste and rather inefficient processes of production of our materials in our society, and how disposal takes place. And we're going to present to you, I thought when I saw it, that just the audio of the piece would make for great listening on the radio. So we're going to play the story of stuff for you. Then when we come back, Annie Leonard is going to be joining us from Berkeley, California, to talk about her film. This is a short film, 20-minute film that has received over 1 million hits on the internet and has gotten noticed in all kind of liberal progressive places like the Daily Kos political blog and many other places as well. So let's do that. We've got it queued up, Laura. Without much further ado, this is the New Capital Show, and this is Annie Leonard's story of stuff.
I got a little obsessed with mine. In fact, I got a little obsessed with all my stuff. Have you ever wondered where all the stuff we buy comes from and where it goes when we throw it out? I couldn't stop wondering about that, so I looked it up. And what the textbook said is that stuff moves through a system from extraction to production to distribution to consumption to disposal. Altogether, it's called the materials economy. Well, I looked into it a little bit more. In fact, I spent 10 years traveling the world, tracking where our stuff comes from and where it goes. And you know what I found out? That is not the whole story. There is a lot missing from this explanation. For one thing, this system looks like it's fine. No problem. But the truth is, it's a system in crisis. And the reason it's a system in crisis is it's a linear system, and we live on a finite planet. And you cannot run a linear system on a finite planet indefinitely. Every step along the way, this system is interacting with the real world. In real life, it's not happening on a blank white page. It's interacting with societies, cultures, economies, the environment. And all along the way, it's bumping up against limits. Limits we don't see here because the diagram is incomplete. So let's go back through. Let's fill in some of the blanks and see what's missing. Well, one of the most important things that's missing is people. Yes, people. People live and work all along this system. And some people in this system matter a little more than others. Some have a little more say. Who are they? Well, let's start with the government. Now, my friends tell me I should use a tank to symbolize the government, and that's true in many countries and increasingly in our own. After all, more than 50% of our federal tax money is now going to the military. But I'm using a person to symbolize the government because I hold true to the vision and values that government should be of the people, by the people, for the people. It's the government's job to watch out for us, to take care of us. That's their job. Then along came the corporation. Now, the reason the corporation looks bigger than the government is that the corporation is bigger than the government. Of the 100 largest economies on Earth now, 51 are corporations. And as the corporation has grown in size and power, we've seen a little change in the government where they're a little more concerned in making sure everything's working out for those guys than for us. Okay, so let's see what else is missing from this picture. We'll start with extraction, which is a fancy word for natural resource exploitation, which is a fancy word for trashing the planet. What this looks like is we chop down the trees, we blow up mountains to get the metals inside, we use up all the water, and we wipe out the animals. So here we are running up against our first limit. We are running out of resources. We are using too much stuff. Now, I know this can be hard to hear, but it's the truth, so we've got to deal with it. In the past 3 decades alone, 1/3 of the planet's natural resource base has been consumed. Gone. We are cutting and mining and hauling and trashing the place so fast that we're undermining the planet's very ability for people to live here. Where I live, in the United States, we have less than 4% of our original forests left. 40% of the waterways have become undrinkable. And our problem is not just that we're using too much stuff, but we're using more than our share. We have 5% of the world's population, but we're using 30% of the world's resources and creating 30% of the world's waste. If everybody consumed at U.S. rates, we would need 3 to 5 planets. And you know what? We've only got one. So my country's response to this limitation is simply to go take somebody else's. This is the third world, which some would say is another word for our stuff that somehow got on somebody else's land. So what does that look like? The same thing, trashing the place. 75% of global fisheries now are fished at or beyond capacity. 80% of the planet's original forests are gone. In the Amazon alone, we're losing 2,000 trees a minute. That is 7 football fields a minute. And what about the people who live here? Well, according to these guys, they don't own these resources, even if they've been living there for generations. They don't own the means of production, and they're not buying a lot of stuff. And in this system, if you don't own or buy a lot of stuff, you don't have value. So next, the materials move to production. And what happens there is we use energy to mix toxic chemicals in with the natural resources to make toxic contaminated products. There are over 100,000 synthetic chemicals in use in commerce today. Only a handful of them have even been tested for health impacts, and none have been tested for synergistic health impacts. That means when they interact with all the other chemicals we're exposed to every day. So we don't know the full impact on health and the environment of all these toxic chemicals, but we do know one thing. Toxics in, toxics out. As long as we keep putting toxics into our industrial production systems, we're going to keep getting toxics in the stuff that we bring into our homes and workplaces and schools, and duh, our bodies. Like BFRs, brominated flame retardants, they're a chemical that make things more fireproof, but they are super toxic. They're a neurotoxin. That means toxic to the brain. What are we even doing using a chemical like this? Yet we put it in our computers, our appliances, couches, mattresses, even some pillows. In fact, we take our pillows, we douse them in a neurotoxin, then we bring them home and put our heads on them for 8 hours a night to sleep. Now, I don't know, but it seems to me in this country with so much potential, we could think of a better way to stop our heads from catching on fire at night. Now, these toxics build up the food chain and concentrate in our bodies. Do you know what is the food at the top of the food chain with the highest level of many toxic contaminants? Human breast milk. That means that we've reached a point where the smallest members of our societies, our babies, are getting the highest lifetime dose of toxic chemicals from breastfeeding from their mothers. Is that not an incredible violation? Breastfeeding must be the most fundamental human act of nurturing. It should be sacred and safe. Now, breastfeeding is still best, and mothers should definitely keep breastfeeding, but we should protect it. They should protect it. I thought they were looking out for us. And, of course, the people who bear the biggest brunt of these toxic chemicals are the factory workers, many of whom are women of reproductive age. They're working with reproductive toxins, carcinogens, and more. Now, I ask you, what kind of woman of reproductive age would work in a job exposed to reproductive toxins except for a woman with no other option? And that's one of the beauties of this system. The erosion of local environments and economies here ensures a constant supply of people with no other option. Globally, 200,000 people a day are moving from environments that have sustained them for generations into cities, many to live in slums, looking for work, no matter how toxic that work may be. So you see, it's not just resources that are wasted along this system, but people too. Whole communities get wasted. Yep, toxics in, toxics out. A lot of the toxics leave the factories in products, but even more leave as byproducts or pollution. And it's a lot of pollution. In the U.S., our industry admits to releasing over 4 billion pounds of toxic chemicals a year. And it's probably a lot more because that's only what they admit. So that's another limit because, yuck, who wants to look at and smell 4 billion pounds of toxic chemicals a year? So what do? Move the dirty factories overseas. Pollute someone else's land. But surprise, a lot of that pollution is coming right back at us, carried by wind currents. So what happens after all these natural resources are turned into products? Well, it moves here for distribution. Now, distribution means selling all the toxic contaminated junk as quickly as possible. The goal here is to keep the prices down, keep the people buying, and keep the inventory moving. How do they keep the prices down? Well, they don't pay the store workers very much, and they skimp on health insurance every time they can. It's all about externalizing the costs. What that means is that the real costs of making stuff aren't captured in the price. In other words, we aren't paying for the stuff we buy. I was thinking about this the other day. I was walking to work, and I wanted to listen to the news, so I popped into a Radio Shack to buy a radio. I found this cute little green radio for $4.99. I was standing there in line to buy this thing, and I was thinking, how could $4.99 possibly capture the cost of making this radio and getting it into my hands? The metal was probably mined in South Africa. The petroleum was probably drilled in Iraq. The plastics were probably produced in China. And maybe the whole thing was assembled by some 15-year-old in a maquiladora in Mexico. $4.99 wouldn't even pay the rent for the shelf space it occupied until I came along, let alone part of the staff guy's salary who helped me pick it out, or the multiple ocean cruises and truck rides pieces of this radio went on. That's how I realized I didn't pay for the radio. So who did pay? Well, these people paid with the loss of their natural resource space. These people paid with the loss of their clean air, with increasing asthma and cancer rates. Kids in the Congo paid with their future. 30% of the kids in the Congo now have dropped out of school to mine coltan, a metal we need for our cheap and disposable electronics. These people even paid by having to cover their own health insurance. All along this system, people pitched in so I could get this radio for $4.99. And none of these contributions are recorded in any accounts book. That's what I mean by the company owners externalized the true cost of production. And that brings us to the golden arrow of consumption. This is the heart of the system, the engine that drives it. It is so important that protecting this arrow has become the top priority for both of these guys. That's why after 9/11, when our country was in shock and President Bush could have suggested any number of appropriate things, to grieve, to pray, to hope. No, he said to shop, to shop. We have become a nation of consumers. Our primary identity has become that of being consumers, not mothers, teachers, farmers, but consumers. The primary way that our value is measured and demonstrated is by how much we contribute to this arrow, how much we consume. And do we? We shop and shop and shop, keep the materials flowing, and flow they do. Guess what percentage of total materials flow through this system is still in product or use 6 months after their date of sale in North America? 50%? 20? No. 1%. 1. In other words, 99% of the stuff we harvest, mine, process, transport, 99% of the stuff we run through this system is trashed within 6 months. Now, how can we run a planet with that level of materials throughput? It wasn't always like this. The average U.S. person now consumes twice as much as they did 50 years ago. Ask your grandma. In her day, stewardship and resourcefulness and thrift were valued. So how did this happen? Well, it didn't just happen. It was designed. Shortly after World War II, these guys were figuring out how to ramp up the economy. Retailing analyst Victor Lebeau articulated the solution that's become the norm for the whole system. He said, our enormously productive economy demands that we make consumption our way of life, that we convert the buying and use of goods into rituals, that we seek our spiritual satisfaction, our ego satisfaction in consumption. We need things consumed, burned up, replaced, and discarded at an ever-accelerating rate. President Eisenhower's Council of Economic Advisers chairman said that the American economy's ultimate purpose is to produce more consumer goods. More consumer goods? Our ultimate purpose? Not provide health care or education or safe transportation or sustainability or justice? Consumer goods? How did they get us to jump on board this program so enthusiastically? Well, two of their most effective strategies are planned obsolescence and perceived obsolescence. Planned obsolescence is another word for designed for the dump. It means they actually make stuff to be useless as quickly as possible, so we'll chuck it and buy a new one. It's obvious with things like plastic bags and coffee cups, but now it's even big stuff. Mops, DVDs, cameras, barbecues, even everything. Even computers. Have you noticed that when you buy a computer now, the technology is changing so fast that in just a couple of years, it's actually an impediment to communication? I was curious about this, so I opened up a big desktop computer to see what was inside. And I found out that the piece that changes each year is just a tiny little piece in the corner. But you can't just change that one piece because each new version is a different shape. So you got to chuck the whole thing and buy a new one. So I was reading industrial design journals from the 1950s when planned obsolescence was really catching on. These designers are so open about it. They actually discuss how fast can they make stuff break that still leaves the consumer having enough faith in the product to go out and buy another one. It was so intentional. But stuff cannot break fast enough to keep this arrow afloat. So there's also perceived obsolescence. Now, perceived obsolescence convinces us to throw away stuff that is still perfectly useful. How do they do that? Well, they change the way the stuff looks. So if you bought your stuff a couple of years ago, everyone can tell that you haven't contributed to this arrow recently. And since the way we demonstrate our value is contributing to this arrow, it can be embarrassing. Like, I've had the same fat white computer monitor on my desk for 5 years. My coworker just got a new computer. She has a flat, shiny, sleek monitor. It matches her computer, it matches her phone, even her pen stand. She looks like she's driving in Spaceship Central, and I look like I've got a washing machine on my desk. Fashion is another prime example of this. Have you ever wondered why women's shoe heels go from fat one year to skinny the next to fat to skinny? It's not because there's some debate about which heel structure is the most healthy for women's feet. It's because wearing fat heels in a skinny heel year shows everybody that you haven't contributed to that arrow as recently, so you're not as valuable as that person in skinny heels next to you, or more likely in some ad. It's to keep us buying new shoes. Advertisements and media in general plays a big role in this. Each of us in the U.S. is targeted with over 3,000 advertisements a day. We see more advertisements in 1 year than people 50 years ago saw in a lifetime. And if you think about it, what's the point of an ad except to make us unhappy with what we have? So 3,000 times a day, we're told our hair is wrong, our skin is wrong, our clothes are wrong, our furniture is wrong, our car is wrong, we are wrong, but it can all be made right if we just go shopping. Media also helps by hiding all of this and all of this. So the only part of the materials economy we see is the shopping. The extraction, production, and disposal all happens outside of our field of vision. So in the U.S., we have more stuff than ever before. But polls show that our national happiness is actually declining. Our national happiness peaked in the 1950s, the same time that this consumption mania exploded. Interesting coincidence. I think I know why. We have more stuff, but we have less time for the things that really make us happy. Friends, family, leisure time. We're working harder than ever. Some analysts say we have less leisure time than any time since feudal society. And do you know what the two main activities are that we do with the scant leisure time we have? watch TV, and shop. In the U.S., we spend 3 to 4 times as many hours shopping as our counterparts in Europe do. So we're in this ridiculous situation where we go to work, maybe 2 jobs even, and we come home and we're exhausted, so we plop down on our new couch and watch TV, and the commercials tell us, you suck, so you got to go to the mall to buy something to feel better, and then you got to go to work more to pay for the stuff you just bought, so you come home and you're more tired, so you sit down and you watch more TV, and it tells you to go to the mall again, and we're on this crazy work, watch, spend treadmill, and we could just stop. So in the end, what happens to all the stuff we buy anyway? At this rate of consumption, it can't fit into our houses, even though the average house size has doubled in this country since the 1970s. It all goes out in the garbage. And that brings us to disposal. This is the part of the materials economy we all know the most because we have to haul the junk out to the curb ourselves. Each of us in the United States makes 4.5 pounds of garbage a day. That's twice what we each made 30 years ago. All of this garbage either gets dumped in a landfill, which is just a big hole in the ground, or if you're really unlucky, first it's burned in an incinerator and then dumped in the landfill. Either way, they both pollute the air, land, water, and don't forget, change the climate. Incineration is really bad. Remember those toxics back in the production stage? Well, burning the garbage releases the toxics up into the air. Even worse, it makes new super toxics, like dioxin. Dioxin is the most toxic man-made substance known to science, and incinerators are the number one source of dioxin. That means that we could stop the number one source of the most toxic man-made substance known just by stopping burning the trash. We could stop it today. Now, some companies don't want to deal with building landfills and incinerators here, so they just export the disposal, too. What about recycling? Does recycling help? Yes, recycling helps. Recycling reduces the garbage at this end, and it reduces the pressure to mine and harvest new stuff at this end. Yes, 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 we should all recycle. But recycling is not enough. Recycling will never be enough for a couple reasons. First, the waste coming out of our houses is just the tip of the iceberg. For every 1 garbage can of waste you put out on the curb, 70 garbage cans of waste were made upstream just to make the junk in that 1 garbage can you put out on the curb. So even if we could recycle 100% of the waste coming out of our households, it doesn't get to the core of the problems. Also, much of the garbage can't be recycled, either because it contains too many toxics or it's designed not to be recyclable in the first place. Like those juice packs, where they have layers of metal and paper and plastic all smushed together, you can never separate those for true recycling. So you see, it is a system in crisis. All along the way, we are bumping up against limits. From changing climate to declining happiness, it's just not working. But the good thing about such an all-pervasive problem is that there are so many points of intervention. There are people working here on saving forests and here on clean production, people working on labor rights and fair trade and conscious consuming and blocking landfills and incinerators, and very importantly, on taking back our government so that it really is by the people and for the people. All of this work is critically important, but things are really going to start moving when we see the connections, when we see the big picture. When people along this system get united, we can reclaim and transform this linear system into something new, a system that doesn't waste resources or people. Because what we really need to chuck is that old school throwaway mindset. There's a new school of thinking on this stuff, and it's based on sustainability and equity, green chemistry, zero waste, closed-loop production, renewable energy, local living economies. It's already happening. Now, some say it's unrealistic, idealistic, that it can't happen, but I say the ones who are unrealistic are those that want to continue with the old path. That's dreaming. Remember, that old way didn't just happen. It's not like gravity that we've just got to live with. People created it, and we're people too. So let's create something new. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the New Capital Show. You've just been listening to something called The Story of Stuff, a 20-minute short film that's available on the internet by Annie Leonard. And you heard it, but you didn't see it. There are animations. You may have heard little squiggly things popping up in the background. If you enjoyed it, and I hope you did, you can watch it again on your computer. You can go to www.storyofstuff.com and revisit it. I'm joined now from Berkeley, California, by Annie Leonard. Annie, welcome to the New Capital Show. It's a pleasure to have you on this morning.
It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Your piece has hit an enormous chord. I think you told me earlier today that there have been over a million hits. Tell me about the popularity of The Story of Stuff.
Well, it's actually been real interesting. We're past a million unique viewers now, so that doesn't even count the people who've come back a second and third time. So it surprised us and inspired us both the number of viewers. The other thing that surprised and inspired us is the breadth of viewers. We are getting emails from Turkey and Pakistan and Argentina and South Africa, literally all over the world, from people saying yes, that they had this growing sense of dis-ease with this consumer mania model, and finally they've seen it articulated. So the geographic diversity and then the age diversity. One day last week, it was amazing. I got in one day an email from a fourth grader who wanted to show it in her class and put all these little electronic smiley faces in the email, and an email from an economics professor at Oxford who asked if he could show it in his postgraduate economics classes.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, that's pretty good, fourth grade to postgraduate economics. You know, so much for a target audience.
Yeah, and so you're getting lots and lots of email right now.
Thousands.
we're lucky to have you on today. And, thanks.
I'm lucky to be here.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time. You have a background in following waste streams. You worked for Greenpeace doing that for a while, and so you've had personal insight in viewing how material makes its way through our society.
That's right. I actually did, as I say in the beginning of the film, I actually did spend 10 years, it was actually closer to 20 years, traveling around the world looking at the factories where our stuff is made and the dumps where our stuff is dumped, both in the United States and abroad, especially a lot of time in Asia.
And you touch on this in The Story of Stuff, but maybe put a little more color on it for listeners in terms of what you saw.
Let me describe to you my first trip to a dump, which literally was like a sort of a religious revelation moment. I was going to college in New York City, and every day I would walk from 110th Street to 116th Street to go to class, and every morning there would be, you know, shoulder-high piles of stuff on the street, and every afternoon it would be gone. And I just started wondering, what is all this stuff, and where is it going? So I took a field trip to the Freshkills landfill, which is the landfill on Staten Island where New York City's garbage goes. You know, rumor is that it's one of two man-made structures you can see from space, along with the Great Wall of China. It's the highest point on the eastern seaboard. I stood there on the edge of this landfill, and if you can imagine, as far as you can see in every single direction are, you know, huge, a mountain of couches and refrigerators and shoes and apple cores and cardboard boxes and books and clothes. And I just thought, oh my God, we have a fundamental problem if we are running our society on this one-way linear flow of materials that trashes stuff at this rate. And then I started traveling overseas and seeing that the problem is even in worse in many cases there, especially as we export this model to so many other countries.
One of the things that I talk on my show a lot about is the fact that the systems and those who prefer and have promulgated the current system hold themselves up as economists and as specialists in handling of finances and production and so forth. And yet, as your film, The Story of Stuff, I think appropriately points out, there are one of the most fundamental things in the economic process, the calculation of costs, is totally absent from many segments of this system. So-called externalities. To what extent are externalities a problem in the system as you've outlined it?
Oh, they are a massive problem and a highly invisible problem from where we sit largely at the Golden Arrow in this country. Externalized costs, as the film says, means that lots of other people are actually paying the true costs for all the stuff that we have. I mean, there is no way that a radio can cost $4.99 or a VCR can cost $19 at Target or something. There's no way that those artificially low costs can exist without the companies that produce them shunting off a lot of the real costs onto the host communities where these things are produced, onto the workers. You know, and I've spent over a decade visiting those places, so I've seen people who've lost their health, who've lost their water supply, who've lost their access to natural resources because of the externalized cost of producing all of this stuff. So it really skews the marketplace, and it sort of undermines the sort of myth of the free consumer. It's the consumer demands this. If the consumer didn't want it, then the consumer wouldn't buy it. The sort of the myth of the sovereign consumer controlling the system, because the whole system is based on such falsehoods.
And then you and I would probably agree that one of the efforts in the lobbying process, perhaps the main effort, is then to weaken regulations which are intended to enforce cost.
Absolutely. And if the regulations here start getting a little too uncomfortable, the companies just simply move the factory over to China or Bangladesh or Pakistan.
Where lobbying takes place in those governments, either if it's a democratic country through a lobbying process, or it could even be through outright payouts to less democratic societies to weaken regulation.
The public's very different in a lot of these other countries too, because they simply don't have the access to information that we have here, and they don't have the democratic space and the mandated role in some decision making. As weak as our democracy is here, we do have a lot more access to information and safety to participate than in a lot of other countries.
Would you say then that the conservative resistance to, you know, what they would call world government or global government, what progressives might call just, you know, multinational rules and laws, that the attempt there is to schism countries from each other and make the lobbying process possible?
I think that's a piece, but I don't think the conservatives are against all global laws. They just want to have their global laws. That's why they have the World Trade Organization. There's a lot of global laws in place right now that they love, but that's because they created them and it serves their corporations.
If you're just joining us today, this is the New Capital Show. I am Leo Gold, your host, and my guest today is Annie Leonard, who is the... Annie, you directed it, you wrote it. Tell us who was involved in the story of Stuff.
Well, it's based on a live talk that I've been giving for a number of years, but it's Free Range Studios that really captured it on film. Whenever I give the talk live, people always say, you should make a movie. And it's a really hard talk to capture.
It sounds like Al Gore's experience when he was...
I hope our result is a little more lively and thought-provoking than his, uh-huh. though. But Free Range Studios has an office in Berkeley and in Washington, D.C., and they've made a whole bunch of different short political films, and I recommend everyone go and visit their websites to see other examples. But I think they just did a marvelous job of capturing the sort of popular education simplicity of the original talk and, you know, making it fun and informational and easy to swallow.
And then you had to have financial backers as well to produce it, I'm assuming.
That's right. But, you know, I gave the talk live, and every time I gave the talk live for years, people said, you should make a movie. And so I just collected all their names, and when we finally got together a proposal, I called them all back up and said, remember me? And dozens of people across the country, including some really progressive, wonderful foundations, all pitched in to make it possible.
Mm-hmm. You know, I recently bought a new television.
Mm-hmm.
The television that my wife and I had in our bedroom must have dated to 1970, and the screen was very small. You know, it was almost like 1 foot diagonal in size. And we upgraded to one of these flat panel televisions. Did I do a bad thing?
No, it's not as simple as that. Absolutely, making the flat panels is a progress considering compared to the old ones in some ways, which is dematerialization. If we can figure out a way to meet our needs with less materials, that's a good thing. You know, the old televisions have 4 to 7 pounds of lead in them. The new ones are much less toxic, so, you know, and they use much less energy. So it's definitely a step in the right direction. I'm not against technological innovation. What I'm against is technological innovation that does not include environmental and social indicators. So, for example, in computers, we look at computers or electronics, there's a thing called Moore's Law. Charles Moore predicted decades ago that the technological capacity of computers would double every 18 months.
Gordon Moore.
Oh, Gordon Moore.
Gordon,
sorry about
that. No problem.
Predicted this. And who's Charles Moore? I don't know where that came from.
It must be his brother, his twin brother.
So that's basically been true, and that that prediction has held true, and that technological advances in computers have provided a lot of benefits, you know, using less materials, great communications and medical advances. But why has there not been a corollary criteria for the environmental impact, the public health impact, the social impacts to also improve double every 18 months? Why is that not on the designer screen?
Are we seeing it now? I mean, people like William McDonough with books like Cradle to Cradle, and the idea that the ideas that he has been promoting in sustainability and reuse of materials, reduction of waste streams, are we in the middle of it now? Is it happening?
Not in the middle. We're in the very start of it. You know, and people like Bill McDonough have been phenomenal leaders and pioneers on this, as has Paul Hawken and a number of others. Really, one of the greatest places of leadership right now in this is the European Union. The European Union has been passing these amazing laws. For example, one that requires that a huge number of toxics be taken out of anything that plugs in. You know, so computers or microwaves or hair dryers or any of these things that plug in Europe have to now be free of lead, cadmium, brominated flame retardant, a whole bunch of different toxics. Yet those same companies are still producing the stuff here for us that have those toxics. So I think we do have some companies here that are beginning to be real leaders, but a great place we can look for examples and proof that this works is the European Union.
Yep. My guest today is Annie Leonard, the director, writer of The Story of Stuff. You can watch this internet film at www.storyofstuff.com, right, Annie?
Yep.
www.storyofstuff.com, and I encourage you, if you've got some time, to go back and take a look at it. We played the audio portion of the film earlier in the show. We may have time for a few calls today. If you want to get in, 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT is the number. Annie, it blows my mind that we're here in Houston, Texas. We have a curbside recycling program, and I can put most materials out. We don't collect glass here, and I've argued with city officials about that, and they've given me reasons. But there is, I think, absolutely little if no regulation whatsoever on commercial businesses to recycle waste streams, whether it's a restaurant that is going through vast numbers of bottles and plates and cartons a day to huge factories. How can that be, and I'm assuming that's the case in many cities, how can there be so few regulations on our businesses?
Well, that's outrageous. Now, your citizens should get together and demand that there be a zero waste policy there. It's the case in a decreasing number of cities. I'll tell you, so many cities are getting on the bandwagon. I'm lucky enough to live in the Bay Area, where our governments have a very serious commitment.
Okay, well, tell us about that, because you're lucky, and we're in Houston, and we're not, and it shocks me here in Houston. We've got a mayor who claims that he's progressive, and I think he's done some good things, but there's absolutely no regulation here. What's going on there at that level?
You know, I would guess that he's either not paying attention or that industry is talking to him a real lot. Some people say that recycling is simply too expensive because you're having to pay to recycle the stuff. But again, that's not looking at the externalized costs. It's not looking at the avoided disposal costs. The cost of putting it in a landfill, that's going to be polluting for 200 to 300 years that someone's going to have to pay for, not even considering the upstream and downstream waste from making all the new stuff. Anytime that you can recycle stuff, you're avoiding that upstream mining and harvesting and processing and avoiding having to replicate all that. So recycling has enormous environmental benefits. Now, San Francisco has a great program. I'd encourage your listeners to call your city and ask them to look at San Francisco, come out and take a visit. San Francisco has reached over a 65% diversion. That means that 65% of the waste that they were putting in landfills is now being composted or put back into productive use through recycling. And there's no way they could have done that without engaging the businesses. Well, that's an outrage. You guys don't have the businesses on board yet.
And so it's happening in San Francisco at the commercial level as well. For example, what happens at restaurants? What are the regulations on, say, a restaurant in San Francisco? Before they are allowed to go into business, do they have to provide a waste disposal plan to the city?
I don't know if they have that step or not. I'm sure the Department of the Environment could tell you, but they do all recycle. But more than that is they all compost. I mean, I composting sort of has this, like, hippie backyard reputation, whereas composting is actually a really critical piece if you're looking at reducing the waste stream and reducing the climate impact, because it's all the rotting organics that creates the methane, which is such a powerful greenhouse gas. So all the restaurants in San Francisco now compost. I mean, that has been a huge reduction in waste generated from those restaurants.
Yep. We've got Michael on the line for Annie Leonard. Michael, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Thank you. I have to excuse my voice. I have laryngitis.
Okay.
I really appreciate your film. I actually got it, had it emailed to me a few weeks ago and watched it, put down my work so I could watch the whole film, and it's wonderful. But my question is, America was, it used to be, you know, buy made in America, GM cars and appliances and home furnishings were built to last for a long period of time. And then, of course, everything is made overseas now and built to last just a short period of time. And then you think Walmart was created into its, huge on the basis of made in America. Now they've, just turned or made a 180-degree turn. So why doesn't anyone step in and, pull us back and produce these kind of materials we were accustomed to?
Annie?
Are you saying why don't any of the companies start making this stuff back in the U.S.?
Yeah, why? Michael's expressing dissatisfaction with the quality of the products that are coming into our stores from overseas. Michael, you want to know why are we not making quality products in this country again? Is that right?
Right. And marketing on the fact that, made in America, like American Apparel does, but, they're just one of the stores that... Why aren't any entrepreneurs taking on that? And is it just the cost?
Annie, want to maybe just talk about the quality versus cost trade-off that has become prevalent in our society.
Well, yeah, I have a couple of thoughts on that comment. One is it's about externalizing costs. If companies are looking to sell as many and as rapid as things as possible, they want to look for the cheapest ways to produce it, and that's why a lot of them move overseas where labor and environmental regulations and everything else is so much weaker, so it's just a lot cheaper to make them. And that shows what we just said, is that the focus is on quantity, on selling as much as possible rather than quality. And that really goes into the concept of planned obsolescence, where things are really made, designed to be disposable and replaced as soon as possible. And while the production might be happening overseas, the decision to do it and the design is happening here in the U.S. So I still think we have a lot of leverage over the company officials in this country where those designs are being made and approved. And one of the best things that we can do to support our local economies is to buy local as much as possible, whether it's food, whether it's products. If we buy local, we're encouraging local production, and we're decreasing the transport miles that all of our stuff has to go on, which will help reduce the climate problems.
But, Annie, aren't free marketeers in this and other countries going to say, look, if you want an excellent Made in America flashlight, you can go to Tiffany's and get one. They've got them, and you're going to pay more, and it's going to last for 100 years and so forth. And if you want a $4.99 flashlight, you can get one at Walmart. We have a system that provides products for all needs and all levels of the socioeconomic class.
The problem is that a lot of people are paying the cost for that $4.99 flashlight who weren't involved in the decision-making.
Uh-huh.
I have spent almost 20 years visiting factories in India, in Bangladesh, in China, places where those $4.99 flashlights are made, and I have seen the communities with health impacts. Their water, I mean, sometimes their little streams of water actually catch on fire. They are so contaminated with effluent from these factories. That $4.99 flashlight is not actually cheaper. It's just that somebody else is paying. And the more that we can get economic regulations that require those costs to be included, the more we will have a real free market. Right now, it's really the illusion of a free market set up with rules by big corporations to benefit big corporations.
Michael?
I've got one more.
Real quick.
These countries are becoming dependent on our consumerism. What happens if we all wake up one day and decide not to buy anymore? What's going to happen to those countries? It's kind of scary.
It is, but you know what? It's also scary to just continue the way that we're going. Right now, this one-way linear flow and this obsession on growth, it's leading to ecological collapse, it's leading to social inequity, it's going to be a problem. Now, making a transition to a sustainable and equitable society is also going to be difficult, and it's going to be a problem. But the way I see it, we have a choice of a problem that we are at the effect of that leads us to someplace worse, or a problem and the hard work and the disruption that we're in control of, and we say, look, we've got to figure out how to reorganize our economic rules so that we're promoting sustainability and equity. And I'm not saying it's going to be easy, and it's not always going to be fun, but way better to be proactive than to just, you know, march forward to the mall blindfolded and wait till the whole system just explodes.
Right.
Michael, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
So, Annie, getting the externalities out of the system, which is to say putting cost and placing cost where it appropriately belongs throughout the system, and if the system is global and international, then cost must be allocated globally and internationally, is absolutely crucial and critical to getting price signals correct, to getting supply and demand curves correct, to getting production and consumption correct. Is that right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, let's move right along. Let's take Krista next. Krista.
Hi.
You're on.
Thank you. Annie, congratulations on the success with your story of stuff. I think it's fantastic.
Thank you.
And I can appreciate what you're saying, your astonishment with Houston's lack of sort of citizen outcry with the city officials about our recycling program. And having lived in San Francisco for a while before I moved here, one of the things that I know happens there is the social pressure, peer pressure, so to speak, in daily life to have a consciousness towards recycling and conservation. So my question for you is, what I think you've done is so innovative because it's political, it's artistic. What are some other innovative programs or movements that you've come in contact with that are not, say, people going directly to their city officials, but people influencing one another in peer pressure ways? Do you understand my question?
Sort of cultural shifts, you mean?
Yeah, social cultural shifts.
Well, Annie, your website has you don't only provide a diagnosis of the problem, but you provide links all over the website, from what I could tell, to other organizations and other websites where people might find answers to the questions that you pose.
Yeah, we have a couple hundred organizations listed there, and one of the things that's really exciting when you start looking at the solutions is all of the different avenues for getting involved in this. There are people working on the design edge, like Green Blue and Cradle to Cradle, that are working to design products better from the beginning. There are groups like Center for a New American Dream who are working on redefining what it means to have progress in this country. There's really funny sort of, you know, cultural jammers like Reverend Billy and his Church of Stop Shopping that are out there. There's so many different ways to get involved. One of the things I often tell people is that the good thing about such an all-pervasive problem is there are so many ways to help that we don't even have to do something boring. There are an infinite number of ways to get involved in this. And luckily, there are organizations all along the way that can help plug people in. So whether you're into electronics or local food production or getting ecological consciousness into schools, I mean, we have organizations that can help.
Yeah, and those can be found on the website. And another nice thing is that for each section of the story of stuff, you break it into extraction and production and distribution. You discuss those more in depth in each of the segments, and then you also provide some links for each of the segments as well.
That's right. On the website, you can watch the movie. You can also click to get deeper information about it. And also, you can get a bunch of resources if you want to help spread the story of stuff. We have house party kits, downloadable screening posters to advertise screenings, suggested discussion questions and group activities for groups to explore the problems and the solutions even further. I really encourage people to poke around on the website.
Okay. Next up, let's take Judy. Judy, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Hi. I live in an apartment complex. It's for seniors, and it's distressing that every day when I go to the mailbox, there's trash receptacles there, and all the stuff that goes in, paper stuff from, you know, the mail that goes in there, distresses me, and I try to collect as much as I can, but my car is full of recyclables all the time, and I have to drive at least 20 miles to, you know, distribute this stuff, and mostly my, like 99% of my mail is stuff that I just automatically take out of the mailbox and put into a bag in my car and drive all over town. So my question is, how do I find out how to get a recyclable place near me? And I don't have a computer.
Ooh, maybe you can use a computer in the library, because there are a couple of great online resources that don't just look to recycle the stuff, but go upstream, which is to stop the flow. One that I would love to bring your listeners' attention to is a new website called Catalog Choice. Mm-hmm. And anybody can log on to Catalog Choice and enter in the names of their unwanted catalogs, and they will stop those catalogs from coming. I have done it. Millions of people around the country have already done it. It's only been launched for about 2 months.
And it works?
And it works. A couple of the catalogs are refusing, so Catalog Choice is, you know, gearing up for a bigger fight. But the vast majority of the catalogs are absolutely agreeing, and the ones that don't agree, we're going to force them to.
Mm-hmm.
So I recommend people look at Catalog Choice. There's another group called the Center for a New American Dream that has a Get Off Junk Mail kit. But you do need to
access. I've tried to get off the junk mail, and I've requested it through the post office, but it worked like one time, and that was it.
It's hard. That's why we need a national do not mail list, like we have a national do not call list. And there are organizations working on that, because it's far better to stop the flow of all this unwanted mail than just to recycle it. But look at Catalog Choice. That takes care of a big bulk of the junk mail.
Okay, Judy, thanks for the call.
And as far as how to get a recyclable place near me, who do I call about that?
No, Judy, we'll have to find somebody in the city of Houston. Why don't you send me an email? Go to New Capital. Do you have a computer, Judy?
No, I don't.
Okay, why don't you call here at the station, and we'll help to find you a recycling place that's close to you, okay?
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Okay, we've just got a few minutes left, and my guest today is Annie Leonard. Annie has directed The Story of Stuff, a web... What do you call it, Annie? A short film? A web short?
Short film.
Web short. www.storyofstuff.com. You can go there and watch this film, and it has provoked an enormous and positive response from many, many people. Tell us, we talked a bit earlier in the show, Annie, about the response, but just give us a little more information about what sort of things you're hearing from people who view it and who contact you.
Well, the biggest category of people who are responding are just individuals that are just saying yes. You know, they're saying that they had this growing sense of dis-ease and they hadn't heard the problem articulated in such a way. So the biggest respondents are just individuals. The next biggest respondents are teachers. I cannot tell you how many teachers in the United States and around the world, all the way from elementary to university level, are saying that they want to use this in their classes. So we're actually working with a couple of organizations now to develop a teaching companion or a curriculum to work with teachers. And then the third biggest response are requests for it to be translated. Mm-hmm. Now, we made the film largely for a U.S. audience. We were sorry to have to do that, but the longer presentation that it's based upon is an hour long and has more international stuff, and we just couldn't include an hour. So we figured, well, this will mostly be for the U.S. We'll make another one later for international. Yet we have been flooded with requests for it to be translated all over the world. And one of the things that I've talked to with these people overseas is we send them our dirty products that we don't want. We send them our dirty factories that we don't want. We send them our waste that we don't want. But I believe that the most hazardous thing that we export overseas is this way of organizing an economy and industrial production, this toxics-based, one-way, linear production system. And a lot of people in other countries are saying that this consumer mania is just coming, and how empowering it is to see somebody from the heart of it in the United States critiquing it. So we are now translating it into Spanish, Turkish, Hebrew, Portuguese, into Chinese, Russian, Hungarian, into dozens of languages by popular request.
I mean, Annie, don't we face this as a major global problem, the fact that that in China and Russia and India, these cultures are just at the beginning of adopting the way of life that this country has had for the past 50 years.
Absolutely. I just saw an article, a cover of a magazine that said, can the world afford, or can the world survive China living like the U.S.? And my question is, can the U.S. survive? I mean, can we survive living
right.
this way just ourselves?
Right.
We simply do not have enough resources for the entire planet to consume at the rates we do. And remember, half of the world's population is still living on less than $2 a day. There are a lot of people that actually need to increase their consumption. And so we have a situation where either we're going to say, we in the U.S. are going to continue consuming in such wasteful ways, and too bad for the rest of you because you came on board too late, or we're going to have to scale down our consumption here to make room for these people who literally do need to increase their consumption.
And I think Jared Diamond recently in the New York Times had a great editorial about this, talking about
fantastic.
The fact that there needed to be a change in the relative levels of consumption across the world. I think that was a few weeks ago. Here, I'm handed something by Oseye, who says there is recycling West Park east of Fountain View. On West Park east of Fountain View, they take glass, paper, and other things. So I think it was Judy who was asking. So on West Park east of Fountain View, I hope that will help. We've got time for about one more call now. Let's take Bill. Bill, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Hi, thank you much. This is a fabulous show.
Thank you.
I have two questions, and I'll hang up and listen. Number one is, I just heard the other day, and this is down your line also, something about solar energy and waste and the production of energy from the use from the doing the two. And I don't know if you know, I just heard it the other day. It's a new research into this area of solar energy and waste products. And the other one is has Annie looked at any of the import tariff regulations that we use on imported products and how we can have an effect on what it takes place in these third world countries if we do this appropriately? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Annie, any thoughts on those?
On the import tariff regulations, I'd recommend a new book that's called Exposed. Exposed is a book that documents what the European Union has done in terms of their new regulations for controlling the imports of electronics and other products that they have to be toxics-free, like cosmetics, electronics, a lot of things that in the U.S. are loaded with toxics. In Europe, now those toxics are illegal to be in those. And what Europe has found is not only has that protected the people in Europe from exposure to these things, but it's forcing positive change in China because that's where so many of these things are made. So simply by saying that they don't want toxics coming into their country, they've been able to encourage thousands of Chinese factories to figure out how to manufacture these things without toxics. So that's a wonderful book, Exposed, by Mark Shapiro.
Annie, we are just about out of time. I want to thank you very much for being my guest today. What's next for you in the story of stuff?
Well, you know, we're just being flooded with different opportunities right now. It's really exciting to see the response. We're looking at producing a book based on the story of stuff, and we're also beginning to think about the story of stuff part two, which will focus more on the green arrow and the solutions and, you know, the positive alternatives. A number of people have said it's too much on the problem, and they want to hear about the solutions. There are so many exciting solutions happening all over the world, and so we want to focus on that piece.
Do you have any American companies or any companies that have approached you and said, yeah, we back this and we like it and we want to be a part of this?
A couple of different companies have said that they'd like to use the film in their internal employee sustainability education programs, but that's about it so far.
Yeah. And you mentioned teachers. Have any teachers, you say that teachers are interested? Is it getting screened in schools, to your knowledge? Are there any schools that say they don't want it to be screened? I'm wondering about that.
We've gotten just two or three emails saying that they thought that some of the concepts or some of the language, the Bush joke or the you suck on the commercials were inappropriate.
Yeah.
But that's like two or three emails out of 3,000. We have gotten literally hundreds of emails from teachers all over the country and internationally telling about really innovative ways that they've used the film in their classes.
Mm-hmm.
So many so that I did a blog post that says, attention all teachers, because so many people were writing to me telling me about great stories of using this film in their class, and I wanted the teachers to be able to talk to each other. So if there's any teachers listening, go to storyofstuff.com and look for the blog post on teachers, and you can read what other teachers have done and share your own ideas or experiences with using the film in classrooms.
Annie, thanks again, and continued success to you and the Story of Stuff. I think you're doing wonderful work. It's been great to have you on the New Capital Show today.
Well, thank you so much. It's been great to be here.
Okay, this does it for another edition of the New Capital Show. Today's show was produced by Bob Wilkerson, engineered by Laura Slavin. Our internet engineer is Stephen Reitman. We will be back with you 1 week from today, and you can find us at www.newcapitalshow.com. You can send me email if you want to sign up for our newsletter. Would be welcome to have you as a member of our mailing list. Until then, I hope you have a great week. Take care. Back next week.
For Prince Among Slaves, The True Story of Prince Abdul Rahman, screens on February 2nd at 6 p.m. at the University of Houston, Cullen Performance Hall. The film explores an often untold story of Black History Month, co-sponsored by KPFT 90.1, KUHT Houston PBS, Mercy Community Center, U of H Urban Experience Program, and the Houston UPF Pioneers Club. Admission is free, but seating is limited. For more information and to RSVP, visit princehouston.org. This is KPFT Houston.
Have you ever wanted to discover what KPFT is like during its most energetic moments? Now is your chance. In just a few weeks, KPFT kicks off its winter pledge drive, and we need your help to make it a success. You can put your spare time to use this February by volunteering to answer phones during the drive. Our phone volunteer trainings are Saturday, February 10th at 11 a.m. and Wednesday, February 13th at 6 p.m. The sessions will be held at KPFT Studios, 419 Lovett Boulevard. You'll meet KPFT listeners just like you, make new friends, and help this community radio station. In just an hour or two, you can help us handle pledges. Your efforts make a big difference and can make this a fun and successful drive. Evenings and weekends are available. Again, those phone volunteer training dates are Saturday, February 10th at 11 a.m. and Wednesday, February 13th at 6 p.m. They will be held at KPFT Studios, 419 Lovett Boulevard, near downtown Houston. Visit kpft.org to RSVP for the training, or email volunteer at kpft.org.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.